see counsel for our next matter are beginning to settle into table, and please go ahead and do that. I'll just call the case. Our matter set for 12:05 today is, and we're a little bit early, so I very much appreciate everyone being here, is file number A19-0060, so it's Benjamin Walter Item, I hope I'm saying that correctly, petitioner appellant versus Deborah Louise Item, respondent. So, counsel, I'll just very briefly say, you know, take whatever time you need to get settled, and then we are ready and looking forward to listening to your arguments today. Of course, the clock is there so that you know how fast your time is ticking away, and we encourage you to keep an eye on it. With that, we are ready to proceed. So, appellant, go ahead when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the appellant, Benjamin Item. Appellant is before the court this morning seeking reversal of the trial court's denial to him of spousal maintenance modification. In so denying, the trial court abused its discretion. The purpose of spousal maintenance is intended to assist a former spouse in meeting her needs given the marital standard of living when her resources are insufficient. Minnesota Statute Section 518.8.39 allows a party to seek spousal maintenance modification under a variety of circumstances, including a substantial change in gross income of the obligee or substantial decrease need for maintenance of the obligee. The requisite change can be and is shown in this case and in a number of ways, but one alone would suffice for reversal of the trial court's denial of spousal maintenance modification in this case. Here, contrary to the trial court's ruling, there has been a substantial change in circumstances. Here we have substantially increased gross income of the respondent, the obligee.
Going from nothing to $18,000.
That's exactly right. And what happened is, I think the trial court, for some reason, looked at the income as being what she got in spousal maintenance, not in the fact that she had zero, her baseline is zero. So we go from zero to 18,000, and that is a substantial change in a substantial increase in income.
Well, part of the challenge, I think, in a case like this is when you start with a stipulated dissolution. So we don't have any findings in the first instance based on, you know, presentation of evidence as to reasonable expenses and income. But as I read the dissolution judgment, I mean, there certainly seems to be an expectation that wife would go back to work, that she would work fuller part-time, and that's just sort of built into the thing. So that is that something that's appropriate for a court to consider when deciding whether going from zero income to $18,000 is a substantial change in the circumstances that existed or were anticipated at the time of judgment?
No, because I think what happened in this case, what's interesting about the judgment and decree is the fact that it specifically accepts out from any modification, part-time employment, temporary employment, and what we have here is full-time employment. So with that in mind, I mean, that could be a basis for modification. So clearly, under the judgment decree and the stipulation, the reading it as written is the very idea that if a respondent obtains full-time employment, that could be a substantial change in income triggering the spousal maintenance modification.
But how do you deal with the fact that, as I think the district court had in its findings, there at the time of dissolution, which ended up in the stipulation, the wife had this vocational assessment, I think it was, that said, you know, she has a capacity for $30,000, and since what she's earning isn't close to $35,000 yet, that you know, while I understand it, what you're saying, that it technically could be a basis, but that's not part of an abuse of discretion to say that it's not a substantial change.
Well, I mean, what the fact is that respondent is working under, not within her earning capacity, but that aside, I mean, the fact is that didn't, as I read the judgment and decree, there's nothing in the judgment and decree imputing income to her on her earning capacity. And you look at child support, it's at zero baseline. So you don't have the normal indicia that you're somehow factoring in some kind of vocational into the judgment and decree. And I think that's, again, why that one paragraph in the judgment decree is important, about the fact that if she has temporary, secondary, you know, we're not going to consider that for modification, but full-time employment we are.
But I don't know. To me, part of this discussion of, you know, especially when there was evidence, although not a finding, about potential to earn income at the time of the dissolution that exceeds what she in fact is earning now, it seems to me that the trying to distinguish between part-time, full-time, suggests that, you know, the modest nature of the income increase from 0 to 18 makes a difference in terms of whether that's substantial enough to modify maintenance.
I disagree. I mean, you've got an 18,000 number. I mean, just going 0 to 18, I think, is substantial. And we also have the fact that it is full-time employment. I mean, it might be, you know.
So what I struggle with, and I think it's similar to what the district court was struggling with, is looking at paragraph G, it actually has several terms. Doesn't have the word full-time employment in there, but it's got part-time employment, temporary employment, or earned secondary income. Seems to imply that in all of those scenarios, the secondary income will not be considered in modification. So is this secondary income because it's not her living up to, you know, her earning
It is non-secondary income.
Well, I think district court decided that this language was ambiguous and, you know, gave the court an opportunity then to make some findings.
Well, but ambiguity, as you know, is whether it's ambiguous or not is a question of law for the court. And reading it, I don't view it as ambiguous. That, I mean, it is clear that if she is in these other categories, then it's not considered, but she's not in those categories. I mean, she admits this is her full-time employment. It's not secondary. It's not part-time. She's never asserted that. So based on the language of the judgment and decree as applied to the facts of record, the trial court abused its discretion in concluding under these facts that there wasn't a insubstantial increase in the obligee's income.
Does the district court have some measure of discretion in deciding based on the record overall what's substantial versus insubstantial? I mean, is a $5,000 full-time job substantial? Is it $18,000? I mean, does the court have discretion to make that call?
Well, you always get into what is substantial. I'm sure there is, I assume, some discretion. But when I look at the case law of this court, the fact that you get as $1,000 a month more, the court has always found that substantial. So I don't know how the district court, on what basis the district court would rule this not substantial. And I think that the error of the trial court here was the fact that it was equating the baseline to be her $9,000 a month spousal maintenance versus that she was at zero. And that's where the trial court's error was. So that really is where the abuse of discretion comes in here. I mean, when you have an $18,000 increase in income from going from zero to 18, I mean, that is substantial. And I could find no case where the court has ever held that it is not. Again, while the court has, I mean, you can get some wiggle room on substantial, I don't think you have it here. The second prong with regard to seeking modification is on decreased need. Now, in that respect, what we have is we have the documentation of the respondent's spending, and it shows that she has decreased need for maintenance. In 2013, we have the stipulated $9,000 a month to meet her monthly needs, given the marital standard of living.
Permanent maintenance. I mean, that means something. It's stipulated to permanent maintenance.
Right, but that doesn't, as this court is well aware, doesn't preclude modification of that number.
Agreed, but that is one of the things that gets factored in, isn't it? The fact that it's a stipulated judgment and the parties agreed?
No, and actually this court in Sandy has said that the trial, it says, I mean, you had a stipulation, and the court said the trial court's authority to modify dissolution decree is not dependent on the existence of a stipulation, but rather on a proper showing of a substantial change in circumstances that made the decree unreasonable and unfair. So no, the stipulation doesn't shield it from modification. It may make it more difficult, but it doesn't shield it from modification. Here we have a circumstance where according to the respondent, and she submitted a number of budgets at the time they were going through to figure out the number for spousal maintenance, and the number that she submitted as the marital standard of living for savings and retirement was $800 a month. And that, looking at the record, equates to what the parties were doing at the time of the dissolution. So if you look at her monthly expenses now, which are set out in a chart, and you add $800 to that, you add her taxes, what is showing is that even before factoring in her present employment, that the spousal maintenance she's receiving exceeds her monthly needs given the marital standard of living. And now when we add in the fact that we have her income on top of that, plus we've just had a cost of living adjustment of $753, the record shows that she does not need $9,000 a month in spousal maintenance to meet her marital standard of living. So that is the other grounds on which we sought modification. And the trial court really made no analysis of the numbers other than just basically a conclusion saying it's not met. But again, the numbers are the numbers, and the underlying documentation was presented to the district court. And so based on the documentation presented, she has more than she needs now per month to meet her needs, and therefore her decreased needs is a basis for spousal maintenance modification. So we have two prongs, but either one in and of itself is enough to require the modification motion to proceed. So what we're asking this court to do is to reverse and remand for determination of appellant's entitlement to spousal maintenance modification.
May it please the court, my name is Carrie Osowski. That's Osowski, O-S-O-W-S-K-I. And I represent the respondent, Deborah Item. The respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm the trial court's December 18, 2018 decision. Before bringing his appeal, the appellant didn't make any motion for amended findings, and the standard of this case, or standard of review in this case, is abuse of discretion. Before an appellate court determines there has been an abuse of discretion, it must first determine there has been a clearly erroneous conclusion that is against logic and facts on the record. That is not the case here. Dr. Item attempted to modify his permanent spousal maintenance obligation based on alleged facts, even though those changes never occurred or they were contemplated at the time of the party's divorce. Now, there are two reasons that Dr. Item requested that his maintenance obligation be modified. The first was an alleged increase in his wife's or former wife's income, and the second was a decrease, according to him, in her needs. This court asked appellant's counsel whether or not there is a guideline for what constitutes an increase in Minnesota. Generally, and this is under the child support statute, but it does apply to modification of maintenance as well, there's a 20% increase that has to occur. That's why the court, at the trial court level, said that there was a 17% income increase for Ms. Item based on comparing her spousal maintenance income and her wage income. That's well below the 20%, and that's also well below the combined incomes of the parties. In his brief, the appellant cited Ricketson, Quaterer, and Neary, where there was modification based on $5,000 income increases. I know that's a number that was thrown out earlier by the court. In those cases, those income increases were anywhere from 44 to 57% increases, well over 20%, which again is that guideline that's used here in Minnesota. In regards to any cases that actually determine what changes in income in terms of a dollar amount create a substantial change, there is a case, Borchert, where the obligee's income increased by $5,000 annually, but so did the obligor's.
So when you're talking, when you're comparing, appellant's lawyer suggested the district court erred by comparing apples and oranges, that when you look at a baseline for deciding whether there was a substantial increase in income, whether that's 20% or just substantial, you don't look at what the award of spousal maintenance was. You look at what the obligee was earning from employment or other recurring income, and that the district court, by comparing it to the $9,000 a month, missed the mark.
Well, and either way, the court looked at her income. Even if they had said, we're just looking at wage income, we're not going to look at that spousal maintenance income, there's still not a substantial change. And that's in Halverson, and that's Halverson with an OR, not the ER. And in that case, the obligee's income increased from $0 to $19,000 annually. But again, the obligor's income increased that same amount. And when both parties increase their incomes the same amount, there's not actually a substantial change in circumstances for the obligee.
But wouldn't the obligee have less need if he or she is making more money from employment?
And that would be, you know, a different analysis of this case, just in terms of looking at whether or not there's an income increase for Ms. Item when the party, because the other prong of it also has to be that it creates an order that's substantially unreasonable or unfair. And so, yes, there may be an increase, but because the obligor's income increased the same amount, the order's not unreasonable or unfair. And in this case, the parties disagreed as to what Dr. Item's income increased by. He says it increased by about $40,000 a year using what he calls his base pay with no extra money, which actually is about $6,000 less than his 2017 income. His 2017 income was $456,000 and some change. And then he says it drops down to $450,000 in 2018. So his income increased at least $40,000 a year. Our position was that it had increased much more. We provided some pay stubs for Dr. Item, and it would have been his burden to prove any portions of his pay stub that was shown, and that was that May pay stub of, I believe, 2018. It would have been his burden to say, nope, these things aren't supposed to be included in my income for whatever reason. He never did that. The court included all of that income, and we believe that was a correct finding. Regardless of how this court decides on that specific issue, his income increased by at least $18,000. It actually increased more than double $18,000. So even though there may have been an income increase for the respondent, because the appellant's income increased more than that, this order isn't unreasonable or unfair.
Well, I think what you've just described would support the district court's finding that the appellant is not unable to pay maintenance, that's not the reason that the district.
Correct, and he never alleged that he was unable to pay maintenance. He made that clear. Additionally, the court was asking about the effect of the stipulation on the modification. It does create that higher burden. And in the record, the appellant included several instances when the parties were negotiating where it's clear he knew that she was going to be employed. At one point, she sent him an email and said, you know, I'm going to get a job. If I need to, I'll get a second job to help pay for our daughter's college expenses. The decree does refer to, you know, any income other than primary employment is going to be included. Dr. Item knew that Ms. Item was going to be getting employment. He knew this was going to happen. And so there is a much higher burden for him to have to meet to show that her finding employment and earning wage income makes the order that they agreed to 6 years ago unreasonable and unfair. And he just hasn't done that. The other portion that the appellant uses, or other argument he uses to say that there has been a substantial change making this unreasonable and unfair, is the decrease in Ms. Item's need.
So before you go to the decrease in need, how do you view paragraph G in the judgment and decree? So the parties' stated agreement on maintenance, change of maintenance. The argument I hear appellant's counsel making is that by any definition, the employment that wife is now currently engaged in is primary employment.
And
so it should, by the party's agreement, it should be considered and factored in.
And I would say that, again, this is something where it doesn't really impact whether or not the trial court's order was correct. And part of the reason is there are cases where they say once someone finds employment, that is a basis for terminating spousal maintenance, or it's going to automatically terminate. The parties very clearly put in their stipulation, when the obligee finds a job, this is what happens. And this stipulation just doesn't say that. It just says that if she gets a second job, they're not going to consider that in terms of a modification motion. It doesn't say any income is going to be grounds to make the current order unreasonable or unfair. And it is a little bit ambiguous simply because it doesn't say when she gets a job, this is what happens.
So you're not relying on the language in paragraph G that states, that indicates that wife's part-time employment, temporary employment, or secondary income would not be considered?
It would not apply here. As she states in her affidavits, it is her full-time job. But again, because her income from this job is less than half of what the income increase Dr. Item saw was, it's not a substantial, or it doesn't make it unreasonable and unfair the way that it's ordered. In regards to the decrease in need, Dr. Item said in both of his affidavits to modify maintenance because he did have an earlier motion that was put forth, conducted discovery, and then had a more thorough affidavit later. He says that he's basing part of the basis for his modification is on the decrease in his child support because their child emancipated. But that's not a proper basis for modifying spousal maintenance. When the parties know that a child's going to be emancipating, that's not even a good enough reason to modify child support. And having an increase in funds available to a party based on the emancipation of a child is not relevant to a spousal maintenance modification. That modification does have to be based on an impact on the wages available or income available to a party based on their earnings, not based on whether or not they have a child living with them who's reliant on them. The other large part of Dr. Item's argument in regards to Ms. Item's decrease in need is the retirement savings.
There wasn't evidence that either party was contributing that much to a retirement fund at the time of the dissolution, was there? I mean, this is a changed circumstance in the sense of it's a change in what she is using her income for, isn't it?
No. So one, in his reply brief, Dr. Item points to a pay stub that shows that there were $844.04 pulled from his paycheck, put into savings accounts. And he says, look, this is what our monthly marital standard of living is. But that's one paycheck. He's paid 26 times per year. So $844.04 times 26 divided by 12 months per year, that equals roughly $1,828 and some change. So that's the marital standard of living for those two retirement accounts. And the parties had several other retirement accounts. The other thing the court should consider, and that the trial court considered very clearly according to the transcript from the October 2nd hearing, is the pension that Dr. Item has available to him. He's a pediatric cardiologist here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, earning, according to him, $456,000 a year. Mayo Clinic contributes to his pension. They have been for the entire time that he's been employed at Mayo Clinic, and those funds aren't being shown on his paychecks every month. So during the party's marriage, at the time of the divorce, based on the evidence in the record, they had $450,000 and more than that available to them in retirement savings. And again, that's a commuted value of Dr. Item's pension. That doesn't show what his actual monthly pension amount would be at this time even. In Kampf, the court stated that savings and retirement is an integral part of the marital standard of living when, at the end of a 28-year marriage, the parties had $340,000 in retirement and savings. This couple was married for two fewer years and had over $100,000 more in their retirement and savings. The other important point with this is that, as Ms. Item indicated in emails to Dr. Item that he included with his motion, she didn't know what they were doing with their money. He was the one paying all the bills, managing all the finances. She was guessing when she created this budget. It was, I think this is what I need, so this is what I'm going to save. She also asked for more than $5,000 or $9,000 a month. She asked for $12,000 on numerous occasions. She said $9,000 is the absolute bare minimum that I need in order to meet my needs. And as the court stated in Lee and Hempel, needs are a malleable concept. Bare necessities is more than just food and clothing. It's what does a wife need in order to maintain herself at the same status or rank of her husband. And again, Dr. Item is a pediatric cardiologist at world-renowned Mayo Clinic. They had a very high marital standard of living, and that included their retirement savings. Ms. Item just didn't know what that retirement standard was until after she had received the property division, knew what her spousal maintenance award was going to be, and could sit down with a financial advisor and say, what do I need to save every month? And so she began saving more. But she didn't spend overall more than her spousal maintenance award. She shifted other things around so that she could meet her retirement needs, because she can't save for retirement once she retires. And then she just kept living her life. When she realized that she needed more than what was being provided to her, she went and got a job. She didn't ask for more money from Dr. Item. She just kept doing what she needed to do to try to support herself. This was a nearly 26-year marriage. The respondent forsook job opportunities, followed the appellant across state lines, and supported him, including raising their child throughout their entire marriage. At the end of their marriage, they had a substantial amount of retirement savings and a very high standard of living based on Dr. Item's rank in this community, which he still holds today. Dr. Item did not meet his burden of proof to change or to modify his spousal maintenance obligation. And again, this is a permanent maintenance obligation, so there is a higher standard, especially when this is a stipulated decree. And my client would ask that this court affirm the trial court's December 18, 2018 decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Respondent suggests that the standard is a 20% increase would be a substantial increase. Well, we have this here. There is no case where this court is used as the baseline, the amount that the party gets in spousal maintenance. So you start with what her actual income was at the time in the judgment decree. It was zero. You go to 18,000. Obviously, that's more than 20%. It's over 100%. So using that analysis, there is a substantial change in circumstances. There was a substantial increase in income.
But the amount is still less than what was going to be imputed to her, at least according to the vocational assessment. What significance, if any, and there's a finding by the district court, I know, in this order, nothing in the actual stipulation judgment about it, but there is a finding about that, you know, the ability to earn $30,000 at the time of the dissolution, and that because 18 is less than that, that there's no substantial change.
See, and I don't understand that. All it shows is that she is not earning up to her earning capacity. But the fact is the judgment and decree has nothing imputing income to her. I mean, that would be a different story.
Well, but because it was stipulated. I mean, isn't that why they wouldn't?
Well, no. I mean, stipulated judgments have imputed income. And, I mean, especially when you're looking at child support. I mean, it's at zero, so I think this is a lot to do about nothing. What is interesting is at the time, she'd had, during the marriage, she had some part-time, some temporary jobs, which is interesting. That is accepted out of the modifications. So, I mean, to me, when you're looking at what the circumstances were, they were looking at the fact that if she did obtain permanent unemployment, that would be considered for modification.
So, or at least could be. I mean, the stipulated judgment was it won't be. That certain things won't be, inference that full-time employment could be. Or
correct. And it is a substantial increase in her income. There's been a lot of talk about this Halverson case. What's interesting, in Halverson, the court didn't find that there wasn't a substantial increase in the obligee's income. There the court was looking at it, I mean, it actually made no analysis about substantial change in circumstances. It looked at the fact that there the respondent was getting like $500 a month in spousal maintenance, and the court said, well, with that modest amount, I mean, how did you expect that she was going to live if she didn't get a job? Here we're talking $9,000 a month. So I have a hard time equating Halverson at all with the facts of this case. Turning to the retirement amount, the parties separated in 2011. They divorced by stipulated judgment 2013. The respondent had a number of years, and she had an attorney, she had advisors, and she changed her supposed budget many, many times. The last time was Exhibit 15, which is attached to appellant's affidavit, and that number for retirement savings is $800 a month. And so that is the marital standard of living. Now, what the record shows is that if you take February 2013 to June 2018, which is 65 months, respondent has put in her savings retirement of average of $2,971 a month. So that's $141,000 above that $800 number. Now, the fact that appellant has a pension, I mean, they divided equally what they had at the time of the divorce. The respondent walked away with $250,000 in cash and retirement savings. I mean, spousal maintenance isn't this equalizer, this profit-sharing plan. I mean, the parties go on their separate ways, and she can do what she wants with retirement savings, but the appellant should not have to pay for it. So what we're looking at here is we look at what her actual monthly expenses are based on her own numbers. We add in the $800 a month for savings, and we look at it overall, and the fact is she doesn't need $9,000 a month in permanent spousal maintenance to meet her monthly needs given the marital standard of living, and that's why appellant sought modification and why we're asking this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thanks to counsel. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So thank you.